My guest today is the author and podcaster, Catherine Hansen, and this is a conversation that I, and I suspect many of you, have been eagerly anticipating.
Yeah, for sure. And I was never like that until I started dieting.
But I know that calories can be problematic for people. What's your view on that?
Yeah, that's a great question too. I do think the way you used it as a framework to help you know what normal portions were, I think that's perfectly fine.
But did you ever have the experience of looking to try to blame something else for why your body looked the way that it did and felt the way that it did?
Oh yeah, absolutely. I really love the calls coming from inside the house. I think I might have to use that.
More people are impacted by an overeating disorder than by restrictive eating disorders.
That's a good point. And I alluded to that a little in the beginning, that I tend to see people on both spectrums.
Hey, it's Ryan Reynolds, and I'm here with Keith, co-star of my upcoming film, If, only in theaters May 17th. Do you want to tell people the big news? All right, I'll do. Sign up now and you'll get unlimited for $15 a month and 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan on us.
Mintmobile.com/switch.
Upfront payment of $45 equivalent to $15 per month. Unlimited over 40 gigabytes per month. Face lower speeds. Videos at 480p. Active Mint customers by 5/31/24 get 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan. Auto renews after 6 months. Offer ends May 31st, 2024. Separate Paramount Plus registration required. Terms and conditions apply if rated PG.
This is Paige, the co-host of Giggly Squad. And I want to tell you about a company that I've been loving, Olive & June. Olive & June gives you everything that you need for a salon-quality manicure in one box. And if you break it down, it really comes out to $2 a manicure, which is absolutely insane. It's also so easy to get salon-worthy nails at home with Olive & June. The difference between how your nails used to look when you did them yourself and now with the Manny system is a complete game changer. The best thing about Olive & June, too, is it's a quick dry. It dries in about 1 minute, lasts for 5 days, and full coverage in up to 1 to 2 coats. Visit oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system. That's oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system.
My guest today is the author and podcaster, Catherine Hansen, and this is a conversation that I, and I suspect many of you, have been eagerly anticipating. In 2019, fresh from breast reduction surgery and feeling extremely low, possibly the lowest I'd ever felt about how my body looked, but also what I was doing to it with food, I read Catherine's book, Brain Over Binge, and it is no exaggeration to say that for me, it was life-changing. In the 7 hours it took me to read, highlight, and notate my copy, all of which I did in one session, some might call that a binge, I had something of a software update. What had been confusing to me before became crystal clear, and I knew exactly what I needed to do to move forward. I also knew that rather than being a greedy, lazy, feckless lump, I was a woman struggling with a very real life-limiting eating disorder. But with Brain Over Binge, I had a way out. In sharing her own experience and helping so many people around the world, Catherine has since devoted her life and career to raising awareness about eating disorders, the impact they can have on individuals, and she also shares the tools to help people overcome them. In 2016, she started the Brain Over Binge podcast, and she also coaches one-to-one and in group sessions. When it comes to emotional eating or overeating, it can be easy to assume there is something underpinning it. I myself have written about my experience in magazines and have spoken to many authors and editors, and each and every single one has said to me, can we not find the trauma that caused this problem? And I don't know as if I necessarily agree there has to be a trauma. Like Catherine, I don't believe binge eating has to have an emotional or a psychological cause. I don't believe, and I'm proof of the fact, that you don't need extensive therapy to stop binge eating. I don't believe resetting your relationship with food requires restriction, and I don't believe you have to become a new slash better version of yourself to recover. And truthfully, this position isn't always well received, which is why I'm excited to dig into this topic and really get into it with Catherine. So without any further ado, please welcome Catherine Hansen to the Emma Gunn Show. Welcome, welcome. How are you?
Hi. I'm good. Thank you so much for having me.
I'm so delighted to be chatting to you. And I think where I want to begin, if it's okay, is to find out what it's like for you. You're in Florida, I'm in London. And then a few years ago, some woman you've never met before starts wanging on about how your book has changed their life. And I'm guessing that I'm not the only person who has had this experience with the book since you published it. What is that like for you?
I mean, it's amazing. And no matter how many people I hear from, It's always just, it makes everything I do worth it. Because when I first started writing the book, I didn't know if anyone would read it. I self-published it. I, you know, did all my own editing, and like, I just did not know that it would have the impact that it has. So I'm constantly overwhelmed and thankful that it has been able to reach people and change people's lives.
What was the experience like of writing it?
It took a long time. I recovered in 2005, and I didn't publish it until 2011. And really, very shortly after I recovered in 2005, it was a promise to myself I had made while I was bulimic. I was like, oh my gosh, if I ever find a way out of this, I have to help other people, because I don't want anyone to be stuck where I am. And then when I recovered in a way that wasn't really conventional, as you alluded to in your introduction, it was just really against everything I had learned in therapy. I had just taken a completely different path. And I was like, I have to get this story out here, out there in the world, for people like me who are not helped by those more conventional paths, which do work for some people. And that's great. And I don't want to take away from that, but I think there has to be alternatives. So it took a long time, you know, to get back to your original question, because one, I was kind of scared to put this message out there that went against the conventional therapy approach. And also, it was pretty vulnerable to share what was going on in my life and the details of the binging. I mean, you read the book, you know that I shared a lot of details. So that part. And then I also had 3 children. I now have 4, but I had 3 in the process of writing the book. So like, that slowed it down a little bit as well.
As a mother, I mean, I don't have children, but I would be lying if I said I hadn't thought about what I might potentially have passed on to a daughter had I had children. Have you had that in your own internal kind of, how do I make sure that they don't experience this?
I mean, that's a really good point. And it's something that, you know, I don't blame my family at all, but there was talk, there was always like weight consciousness and comments made that just weren't terrible, but they also just weren't well thought out. And I think that goes on a lot, where mothers just will talk about their diets, will talk about their weight, and not really knowing what impact it's going to have. And this, you know, is something I experienced from many relatives growing up. And I just never wanted to pass that on to my kids. So we never talk about diets. Of course, now they're teenagers and they hear about things and, you know, they do get those influences from elsewhere. But I always wanted the home to be a place where, you know, we focus on health. We enjoy our food. We don't talk about dieting or the way our body looks and things like that. So I think the less people can talk about dieting, and the more we can just promote loving yourself for who you are and how your body authentically shows up, just the less that this problem will affect people into the future.
Okay. I know that we're going to dig in a lot deeper into so much that you've already said, but let's just backtrack to how I always start the show, which is to ask about my guests. Or how would you describe your relationship with risk? Because as I'm sure many listeners will already have clocked, your biggest risk was writing Brain Over Binge in the first place. So how would you describe your relationship with risk before we go into that specific risk?
Okay. I'm actually kind of averse to risk, which is why it was kind of out of character for me to publish it. But I tend to be a more of like play it safe type of person in my life. I worry a lot, a little anxiety, which I know goes along with people who have the personality types to end up getting into eating disorders. So yeah, definitely a little risk averse.
A little risk averse. Okay. Why was it so risky then to put pen to paper?
I guess I imagined more of a backlash from my message, but you know, honestly, it's been mostly positive. Yeah, sure. I do have negative reviews on Amazon. I have had, you know, people in the more mainstream eating disorder fields be kind of upset about the message, but honestly, it's been pretty well received, like a needed message. I think that, like you also said, it's not always a trauma. Like there are people, a lot of people, which we'll dive into more, who just get into this from dieting. Because you restrict your food, it causes a cascade of problems in your body and brain that can lead to binging, and that can lead to you developing this terrible habit of binge eating disorder or bulimia. And, you know, it doesn't always have to be a result of deep underlying psychological problems. And I think that message was needed more than it was like shunned, I guess.
Yeah, I think when I think about an image that really comes into my mind every time I either see the book on the shelf or I think about the experience of reading the book, it's the drive to college and almost that idea of in your head almost sort of planning the food, thinking about what you're going to consume. And I just could really identify with that. And I think for me, that was the thing. It was realizing how much real estate thinking about food took up. And it wasn't just about the eating of it. It was about thinking about it, bargaining with myself about what I could and couldn't have. So, and it was all very convoluted and didn't make any sense. If you had said those words out loud, if you'd written it as text and printed it as an Instagram meme and like, this is my train of thought about the next food that I ingest, it would look absolutely mental.
Yeah. Yeah, for sure. And I was never like that until I started dieting. I mean, when I started restricting my food intake, that's when all those thoughts about food just started consuming me. And I felt like I woke up every morning and went to bed every night thinking about what I was going to eat and planning what I was going to eat and trying to control what I was not going to eat because I wanted to restrict and lose weight. And it just became a complete mess. And eventually my body and brain took over and I binged. And then that became something that got rewarded and reinforced, and just I started craving over and over. And the thoughts that drove that behavior, like you said, it when you step back from it, it sounds absolutely crazy. You know, I felt crazy at the time, but learning about it in terms of the brain, it takes that feeling of I'm crazy away, because it's like, oh, like this is what the brain does. This is how brains maintain habits. This is how the reward center provides motivation for us to get these pleasurable substances. So it all like started to make sense. Oh, like this isn't really me. This is just how my brain is operating.
I think one of the most significant things that you talked about is the sort of the dominant brain and the less dominant brain, the lizard brain. And what's the top brain called? I always forget.
Yeah. I mean, I try to simplify it between the higher brain and the lower brain just to make it easier, but it's really the human brain and the prefrontal cortex. And then the primal brain or the primitive brain is that's the lower brain.
So the thing I always used to fight, sorry.
No, I was just going to say, do you want me to kind of dive into that or do you have a question?
Well, I was just going to say that from the thing that really helped me, honestly, from reading Brain Over Image, and there's lots that really helped me, but it was understanding that the craving to, so say I just had my dinner and I was sitting down in the living room watching television in the evening, and 45 minutes to an hour after I'd eaten, I would be thinking, that would be the message that my brain would be sending me. And then all of a sudden my brain would send me images of pancakes or like something that I knew was in the fridge. And to be able to, from having read the book, I could just go, well, you can think that all you like, but the part of your brain that is going to stand you up, we're not working. We're not moving. So I would just stay seated.
Yeah.
But yeah, explain it totally. In a bit more sort of a bit more detail, because that was pretty crude.
No, I mean, but I think a lot of people can relate to that. And the fact that you learn to stay seated, even though your brain was providing you these images, providing you this temptation, that's really the skill that I try to teach people to step into their higher brain, to realize that the higher brain, our human brain, the prefrontal cortex is the center of our brain that provides us with the self-control function. And no matter what the primitive brain is urging us to do, we have veto power. We can say no to that, even though like we may not have control of what goes through our mind, what we feel driven toward, you can stay seated. And once you really experience that, you know, it's hard to go back, because it's hard to take that lower brain seriously when you realize you ultimately are in control. And if you choose to get up and follow those messages, that is ultimately, you know, your choice. And this is something that not everyone gets right away, and that's okay. Like, we can get out of practice using these self-control functions. There can be, you know, issues that kind of can interfere with us using these self-control functions. So it is something that some people have to build up and learn. So, you know, if right now, today, you aren't able to do this, that's okay. Like, this is a skill you can learn over time.
How has your recovery been? And I ask, and if it's too personal, tell me to step off. But I always describe it as not linear, as a non-linear experience. I don't think there will ever be a time in my life when I'm not aware of the fact that I am in recovery and that I have to stay on top of it. And there have been times, I have to say, I have gone months without incident, but there have been times when I've suddenly caught myself in behaviors that I know are the precursor to binges. For example, standing at the kitchen counter eating out of the sort of shopping bag, even though that's not yet a binge, it's a precursor to what binges used to look like. So that's when I think, okay, I need to slow down. How has it been for you?
Yeah, I mean, that's a really good question. I've been recovered 18 years now. And so in a lot of ways, it just feels like a lifetime ago to struggle with food. Like, food is not a struggle in my life. As all normal eaters know, of course there's cravings. Of course there's times that you overeat. Of course there's imperfection. It's not like I'm a perfect eater sitting here today at all, but it's not a struggle. It's not, you know, anything I really think too much about on a daily basis. I do enjoy eating, which I think is perfectly normal as well. But back at the time that I recovered, I think I had an advantage in that I had given up dieting prior to stopping binging. I had really seen that dieting was a huge part of why I started this in the first place. Actually, the biggest reason that I started binging. And I had given it up. I had learned to eat relatively normal portions. So binging was kind of my final piece to bring me back to being a normal eater. And I find that a lot of times this isn't the case for people. People are trying to stop binging and they're also still really attached to restricting. They don't exactly know how to follow their hunger and fullness. They don't know what normal amounts of food look like. So I will say that my experience, like when I stopped binging, that was when I recovered and I was already kind of back to normal eating habits. A lot of people take longer to get there. They may stop binging, but it takes them a year or more to really feel like they're in a good place with food, where they are nourishing their bodies, where they're not restricting, where they don't feel at risk. So, you know, my time, like the time that I recovered, I really felt normal pretty soon after. I had urges to binge for about 9 months after I stopped binging, but it really became easier even in the first few weeks. Once I stopped acting on that primitive drive to eat massive amounts of food, it really started to go away. And that's how our brains work. Like, what we don't use in our brain, we lose. So that desire went away and I was like eating normally. And I thought, wow, like it can really be this simple. And, you know, that's my experience. And I know a lot of people who are very similar, but there is different timelines for different people.
I think for me, I definitely sort of bought into this idea that, like, the food commercials, the food adverts on television when I was growing up, when you'd see the bowl of cornflakes or you'd see people buttering their toast, and they would always use a lot of butter or a lot of spread or what have you. So when I would then do it, I sort of felt like, well, I was entitled to eat that much. And I had to relearn quantities for sure. I wasn't just binge eating. I was just overeating. I was never really satisfied. I would maybe have two slices of toast and I'd be like, well, fancy a third. So I really had to sort of learn that the quantity stuff. So for me, and I've had pushback about this, for me, the best and easiest, and also, dare I say, the free metric that I could use in order to begin to understand what appropriate size portions looked like and felt like, was to use calorie counters. Now, I don't live by those, but for me to understand, to find a normal way of eating that didn't mean or lead to weight gain, that was the easiest way for me to do it. But I know that calories can be problematic for people. What's your view on that?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a great question too. I do think the way you used it as a framework to help you know what normal portions were, I think that's perfectly fine. And I feel like there's two different types of people. And of course, you know, there's many variations in between these two, but there is more of the restricting types, people who really are trying to eat as little as possible and they're binging, and they may need to use calories to make sure they're eating enough. Like, that is one of my recommendations I give to people who don't have a real strong negative association with calories and where it doesn't feel super diety to them, to count, to make sure they're getting enough and make sure you're going over a certain amount in the day. And there's also people who really struggle, seemingly like you, with just constant overeating and really going over the amount of calories that their body needs to function. So in that way, calories can be used as a gentle reminder of how much food you need. And it's doesn't have to be a strict thing. It doesn't have to be something where you get mad at yourself for going over. It's just a general framework that we, you know, we have to have a way to talk about quantities of food, and calories is a good measure. Some people find, you know, actually measuring the food and counting the servings is more helpful. Some people find that, you know, they're already ready for a more intuitive approach, but there's many different ways to sort of structure your eating as you're recovering to make sure that you're nourishing your body, because it's really, really important to make sure you're getting enough food. Like, you can't continue to restrict and also end binging. And also, like, extreme overeating all the time doesn't feel good either. And that's going to affect recovery in a negative way as well.
You alluded to it earlier, but you talked about you were somewhat nervous about how brain over binge would be received because it wasn't necessarily the mainstream message. And I have to be honest in that when I felt comfortable to talk about what I had done, and it took me, I think it was 6 months before, just over 6 months, because I wanted to lose the weight and be confident that I was keeping it off. And it wasn't, as I have done many times, lose the weight and put it back on. I wanted to be confident with that. But I was so excited because I thought, guys, I've done it. I found it. It could really help you. Oh my God, if you're struggling in the way that I was, and completely not realizing that everybody's struggle or journey with this is completely different. I was really surprised to experience some pushback, to be honest. Only the other day I was talking to a friend, and we were talking about how she has also dropped a decent amount of weight recently, but no one can compliment her on it because you can't compliment people on, you can't talk about that anymore because that's become super taboo. You can't say, well, you've lost weight, because you never know what, you don't know what trauma you're going to prod at or whatever it might be. And we were talking and she said, you know what's really rubbish about it though? The fact that it really is much easier to navigate the world in a smaller body. Like, the world is just an easier place and we simply cannot talk about that. But likewise, I've had people, but what was interesting about that conversation is she said, the only thing with you, Emma, is the way that you've done it just isn't accessible to me because you are hardcore. And I took a step back and thought, I don't believe that I'm hardcore at all. So then I went through, I was like, what have I been sharing that makes it look like I have done exactly what I said in the introduction, which has become a sort of hardcore version of myself. And it's very interesting how emotional each lens through which we look at this whole thing is. And I guess now with your coaching as well, how has that opened up your perspective? Because you must be seeing this issue through so many different eyes, so many different sets of circumstances.
Yeah, for sure. I did coaching for a while. I'm actually doing a little bit of it again, but I have a coach that works for me now, Coach Julie Mann, and she does the group and the one-on-one. So I just wanted to kind of clarify that, but I did it for a long time, and she, and working with people, she actually was a client a long time ago and recovered after 40 years. And now she's helping people with this approach. But both Julie and I have seen like so many variations in how people came into this behavior and how people get out of this behavior. And I do think like there are some people who have the experience like we did, that it just flips a switch and you suddenly see, oh my gosh, these primitive urges are not something I have to follow. Some people are more attached to the binging. Like they really, it's easy to say, oh, it's not for emotions, it's not a way to cope. But some people have a hard time letting go of that idea. There's that. There's people who have a hard time letting go of restriction because they really fear what's going to happen to their weight. Those things hold people back, like really clinging to it as a coping mechanism, really clinging to the idea of restriction. And then also just having the habit for a long time, like even Coach Julie, like it took her much longer to access that self-control function because it's so well ingrained. So it took like many stops and starts. So as I work with more people, I do see that the timeline is different for everyone. I wrote a second edition of my book. I don't know if you read the first edition or the second, but I have the second behind me because I wanted to, you did the first. Okay. So I did realize like in the first, it was a little more hardcore, to use that word that you used. It was a little more like, okay, just like, don't listen to your brain. And in the second, I tried to, you know, be a little more sympathetic to the fact that everyone comes to this in a different way and recovers on a different timeline. And yes, these brain-based principles can apply really to anyone, but everyone uses them in a different way. So I hope, you know, the second book, the second edition of Brain Over Binge just kind of includes all of that while still empowering people to take control of this, because I don't want people to just be stuck in a maze of recovery forever.
Mm-hmm. And I also see what you think about the body positivity movement.
That's a big one. I think it's great to have body positivity. Like, I do think it's great. There's nothing bad about having body positivity. I also think that there are certain maybe scientific theories that, you know, maybe we could call facts about health that I'm not sure. Like, that's a hard question. I'm dancing around the issue a little bit because I want people to feel good about themselves. I want people to be positive about their bodies. But if there are health consequences of being in a larger body because of how you're feeding it, because of the excess food, like if someone is in a larger body because that's how their body naturally shows up and that's healthy for them, then great, absolutely, be positive about that, that's wonderful. But I know when I was in a larger body for my personal genetic makeup, because of the binging, because of all these excess, like, terrible foods I was feeding myself on a day-to-day basis, it was horrible for me. And I can only imagine, like, the health that I would be at today, or the lack of health, if I would have kept doing that. So, like, for me to be positive about my body when I was hurting it, I don't know if it would have helped at all. It's a hard thing because I think people need to also be realistic about the behaviors that they're doing and what that's doing to their health.
Did you ever think that it wasn't the food? And the reason I ask this question, and again, I appreciate I'm talking through such a personal lens, but it's even as a trained journalist, it's very difficult for me not to talk about this as a human being. I looked for every single reason other than my actions for why I was always overweight and struggled to maintain my weight. So it was my hormones, it was my ethnicity, it was where I grew up. It was, I suppose I did at some point try to find some sort of trauma that would explain it. It was societal expectations of women. It was the patriarchy, but it was never what I was putting in my mouth. And for me, the book really compounded the fact that, okay, it's the call is coming from inside the house, Emma. So, and for me, that was really confronting, but in a really beautiful and brilliant way. Because actually, if you're looking all the time for a reason why something is happening, and then you just get sharp focus and go, I'm the architect of this, which means if I'm the reason there's a problem, I can also be the solution. That was like, you know, the heavens opened, a beam of sunlight came down, I heard the angels singing, and I felt really empowered by that. But did you ever have the experience of looking to try to blame something else for why your body looked the way that it did and felt the way that it did?
Oh yeah, absolutely. I really love the call is coming from inside the house. I think I might have to use that. It's so true because there are many factors that can contribute to people, you know, being vulnerable to this problem. So, you know, even though those factors could have contributed, like let's say, you know, the patriarchy, for example, like maybe that contributed to your desire to diet, which then contributes to the survival drive to eat so much food. Like, so yes, there are factors that can contribute. Absolutely. But when this habit is developed and when it's maintained, yeah, every time you feel driven to binge, that call is coming from inside the house. It doesn't matter how many other factors you try to solve. Once this is really conditioned in your brain, solving those other things doesn't do much to turn off that drive. So that's one thing I had to really come to terms with. And yes, to answer your question, I absolutely looked for things that were outside of myself that contributed. I mean, that's really how I spent about 6 years in therapy trying to find that answer. And, you know, I think therapy's changing a bit and that's great. But at the time I was in therapy, it was very much like, let's look to your past. Let's figure out, you know, how you didn't get enough love or how you were rejected or why you're using food to soothe yourself. And, you know, looking at it through that lens, but then also like what's going on in your day-to-day life? Like, how is your anxiety leading you to binge? How are you feeling lonely and you're trying to soothe with food? And I found, you know, so many things and I found so many reasons and tried to solve them and nothing seemed to matter. I mean, I could binge when I was happy. I could binge when I was not anxious. I could binge when I was sad or, you know, calm and peaceful. It was very, yes, there were some patterns and links that develop because a lot of times when we do have pain, we look for something pleasurable. So like, it's no coincidence that if we start eating lots of food for whatever reason, then it can become linked to negative emotions, right? And it also, I think that link a lot of times develops because it's suggested to us by mainstream approaches that tell us that's why. So it's all can become very complicated, and none of that really helped me. And I would suggest to the listeners, like, to really take a look. If this is the path you're going down, is it helping you? And if it is, great. Like, if you have stress and it typically leads to a binge, and handling the stress better and coping better really helps you avoid the binge, then that's wonderful. Like, then that's changing your brain. But for me, that just wasn't the case. So looking outside myself just didn't lead to a cure. And it was a frustrating path to be on.
Yeah. Do you remember how you felt when you realized that that it was just you, that you sort of looked, did you do that thing where you looked in the mirror and you were like, okay, it's you and me, let's do this?
Yeah. And as you know from the book, it was a result of me reading a book as well, Rational Recovery by Jack Trimpe, The New Cure for Substance Addiction. It was about drugs and alcohol. And he was very, at the time, it was an alternative to AA. And he was very much like, look, it's not a disease. You do this for pleasure, no matter what you tell yourself. It's a primal drive. He called it the beast brain. And it's you, like, you're choosing this. And I was like, at first I wanted to push back on it because I'm like, no, like, it's my emotions and it's my upbringing and it's all these problems that I have in my life. But like, the more I read, it was like, it was hard hitting, and it was kind of a ego hit, I think, to be like, oh my gosh, it's me. But then it was also very empowering. Like you said, like, all right, we can do this. Cause once there was a solution, like, once therapy just became very confusing. At some point, I like lost track of what I was trying to solve. Like, I was trying to solve the past. I was trying to solve the present. I was trying to become less anxious, when like 18 years later, I'm still anxious, but I don't binge. So like, I don't know how all that stuff was going to eventually lead to a cure for me. So realizing that, oh, the cure is like to not act on the urge to binge. Oh, okay, I can do that. And before, that seemed very elusive because that urge seemed to mean something. Like, in therapy, I learned that that urge was indicative of my emotional void I was trying to fill, or feelings I needed to stuff down, or something really deep and significant. But what I learned after reading Rational Recovery is like, this is a primitive brain function that is normal, and it's desire, and you just have to like separate from it and not act on it. And that was, I mean, it was life changing.
Mm. It's funny, isn't it, how just seeing it through a sort of different perspective can just completely shift how you look at it. The reason I asked about body positivity is because I don't align with it in a way that has made me unpopular in certain conversations with friends and colleagues. And the reason is because I remember, I would say probably 3 or 4 years before I read Brain Over Binge, a friend of mine said, and I would always whinge about my weight, because I was looking for, because as much as I was trying to blame the patriarchy and all of that kind of stuff, I was also looking for my friends to reassure me that actually it's all in your head, and it's really unfair what's happening to you. And obviously they don't, they just hear somebody whinging about their weight all the time. And I remember a friend saying to me, you know what, Emma, just stop weighing yourself and just go by how your clothes feel. And if your clothes feel a bit tight, then just, you know, watch what you're eating for a week. Now, honestly, her advice to somebody else would have been really great, but to me, woefully unhelpful, because I didn't have a handle on what I was eating. I wasn't honest with myself about the quantities I was eating and how much I was eating. So I was never going to be able to exercise that, just take a step off for a week. That was never going to happen. But furthermore, I did stop weighing myself. And then when I got back on the scales about a year later, the weight gain was shocking. So again, it's very unpopular. I weigh myself every single day, and it's desensitized me to that metric. And the only thing I pay attention to is the downward trend over time. I do not pay attention necessarily to the daily weight, but I use that metric to look at that. Anyway, the point about the body positivity movement is, had I really leaned into it, had I accepted it, and had I gone, yeah, you know, I'm going to really get behind this, I would have been willfully denying almost like a very active and very real self-sabotage. And I would have given myself the green light to do that for the rest of my life. And to me, there has been no greater body positivity or body acceptance for me personally than to go, you don't feel good, you're harming yourself, you're eating yourself to a size that is uncomfortable and may potentially have long-term effects, impact on your health. Therefore, your body positivity journey is to get on top of this and to lose the weight. But that is not the global definition of how we really understand body positivity. And that's why I have had some kickback from people.
Yeah. I mean, but from what I hear you describing is like, you are getting back to the weight that is natural and healthy for you. Like, you're not trying to meet an unrealistic standard. You're trying to be your own healthy version of yourself, correct?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And that's what I think that we need to get behind as far as people being body positive is that, like, we all want to be the healthy version of ourselves. I mean, it's not about just accepting a lack of health, because I know how that feels and you know how that feels. So yeah, I mean, what I'm really adamant about is like, some people are at their healthy weight, you know, they're eating normally, they're taking care of themselves, but they want to be, you know, 10 pounds lighter. Well, that's when they really need to lean into body positivity, like that they need to accept their own healthy version of themselves, because we all sort of have a genetic blueprint, and we start going outside of that, we start really trying to suppress our natural weight. It's not going to work. It leads to more weight gain over time. So I think really accepting who, like, your sort of weight range that your body naturally wants to be when you are having healthy practices, when you're not binge eating, when you're being active, that's where the body positivity, I think, comes in, at least the way I teach it. Does that make sense?
It does. What about then, again, because this is something that I've had some pushback on, and I'm guessing that if I've had it, you must have had it over the years, healthy at every size or healthy at any size. Where do you stand on that?
I think the similar thing, that like, if you do have healthy practices and you are eating, you know, in a normal way, that, I mean, not perfectly, no one eats perfectly, that you are having, you know, a healthy activity, that you're not binging, and the way your body's showing up, if it's larger than maybe it should be technically on the BMI chart, then I think, yeah, absolutely, you can be healthy at your natural size, whatever that is for you personally. But when you're having these unhealthy practices, when you are binge eating and you're artificially way over your natural weight, then I don't think that's healthy. So, and I think that the health at every size is the good parts of it, is that it does promote healthy practices regardless of your weight. It's saying no matter what weight you are, you can implement these healthy practices, which do have weight and health benefits. It's not, you know, I don't know exactly like as much about the movement, so I don't want to speak too much about it, but I think objectively, we can't delude people into thinking that unhealthy behaviors are actually healthy. I just don't think that's appropriate.
Yes, I agree. And I won't push you on it too much as well, because I do know that it can be such a contentious issue to sort of, and you don't want to get pinned down for being unsympathetic or for being uncharitable. And I think one of the things that I've had is, especially in the job that I had, which was sort of in magazines and somewhat high profile, if you like, it was like I was bigger and then I got smaller. And then some people felt like I kind of joined the nasty girl club, because I went, yeah, you just have to eat a bit less and look, exercise feels great. And they were like, we thought that you were one of us and now you're doing what everyone else told us to do. Yeah. And I definitely felt that.
Yeah. And there can be that flip side where almost there's a thin shaming when people like do get healthier, then you're not one of us anymore, which I've had some concerns about as well, because my natural body is a little on the thinner side. I do, you know, have a decently healthy diet. I do exercise, and, you know, I do understand that I don't understand what it's like to be in a body that is well overweight or obese. I mean, I was definitely overweight technically when I was a binge eater, but you know, there is an experience that I know that I have not had, therefore I can't speak to in a way that someone who has that experience could speak to. But I do think there is a danger here of us shaming people who are healthy and who lose weight in a healthy, sustainable way, when I think that's a good thing and people don't deserve to be shamed for that.
I call it the Khloe Kardashian effect. It's like Khloe was everyone's favorite Kardashian until she decided to work on herself, lose weight. And now they're like, oh, what has she done to herself? And I think, truthfully, it's rooted in jealousy.
Yeah. And, you know, I don't know her exact story, but if someone is doing something to themselves that's unhealthy to make themselves below their natural weight and really hurting themselves in that way by dieting and restriction, then of course, yeah, like we should celebrate their natural self and not want them to do that. But if someone is bringing themselves from a place of not being healthy and not feeling good and then bringing themselves to a place where they do feel good, then we shouldn't be shaming anyone for that.
Can we talk about food composition? Because the food that you describe in the book that you would binge on, and definitely the food that I would binge on, would almost be like the naughty food. It would be the stuff that I thought everyone else ate and didn't gain weight for, and I couldn't, so I would eat it in secret. And what I've really learned in the last few years is, so say if I kind of, this is a crude way of saying it, but it's almost like, okay, I like eating a lot, but I don't like the effects of eating a lot. So how can I cheat myself into thinking that I'm eating a lot when I'm not actually? And so for me, that's like massive stir fries with tons of vegetables that I'm so tired of eating by the end of it that I don't possibly want to have anything else. And I've got my protein in, I've eaten loads of vegetables, but the calorie count is actually pretty low. So I've had a huge, huge plate of food, but the composition, the component parts of it are actually really good for me. Whereas in the past, I would have thrown in as many noodles, as much rice as I could have done, because I thought that that was what was delicious and that was what everyone else could eat and get away with. And now I don't feel like I'm missing out. So is there another piece of the puzzle which comes into, I don't look at that and think it's restrictive. I look at that and think it's actually quite sort of smart. Because I still feel satisfied. But talk to me a little bit about composition of food, because I think that's an important piece that people don't ever really address.
This is Paige, the co-host of Giggly Squad, and I want to tell you about a company that I've been loving, Olive & June. Olive & June gives you everything that you need for a salon-quality manicure in one box. And if you break it down, it really comes out to $2 a manicure, which is absolutely insane. It's also so easy to get salon-worthy nails at home with Olive & June. The difference between how your nails used to look when you did them yourself and now with the Manny system is a complete game changer. The best thing about Olive & June, too, is it's a quick dry. It dries in about 1 minute, lasts for 5 days, and full coverage in up to 1 to 2 coats. Visit oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system. That's oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system.
Hey, it's Ryan Reynolds, and I'm here with Keith, co-star of my upcoming film, If, only in theaters May 17th. Do you want to tell people the big news? All right, I'll do. Sign up now and you'll get unlimited for $15 a month and 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan on us.
Mintmobile.com/switch.
Upfront payment of $45 equivalent to $15 per month. Unlimited over 40 gigabytes per month. Face lower speeds. Videos at 480p. Active Mint customers by 5/31/24 get 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan. Auto renews after 6 months. Offer ends May 31st, 2024. Separate Paramount Plus registration required. Terms and conditions apply if rated PG.
Yeah, composition is something that it comes up a lot in like the people I've talked to over the years. And as far as the binge foods, most people are eating very similar things, like really high carbohydrates, a lot of fat, sugar there. But honestly, people can binge on anything. I mean, I've had people I've talked to that binge on vegetables. Like it's more rare, but you can binge on anything. And I think sometimes people can trick themselves and think, oh, if I'm just binging on all healthy food, then it's not a binge, but it still can cause harmful effects. Like it's still an uncomfortable behavior. So, you know, incorporating these binge foods into your normal diet is something that we address a lot, like in coaching and in my course, is that people often have questions like, how do I eat these foods then as a part of my normal diet? Like how much of them? So it's definitely something I think that's an individual journey. I tend to tell people to eat in the least restrictive way that's possible for them. And that means like, you know, obviously if you have an allergy, if you have something like celiac disease, you know, you're not going to be eating those foods that create a problem. So their least restrictive way is different from someone who has no food allergies, no food sensitivities. So you really want to be able to empower yourself to eat, to know that you have control regardless of the types of food, regardless of the composition. Like in the example for you, like, yeah, this is the way you like to eat and you like to have a lot of vegetables and you feel like it's satisfying and that works for you, then great. But I think it's important for people to realize, okay, you could also have some noodles and still remain in control. Mm-hmm. I think once you set foods up as these foods I have no control over. These foods are triggers. These foods, you know, once I start eating, I can't stop. It almost becomes self-fulfilling. I do try to encourage people to learn to feel in control around any food and to realize they can eat any food in moderation. That doesn't mean you'll always choose those foods. I think some people think, oh, if I give myself permission to have the pasta, let's say, then I'll never stop. But a lot of times that's a symptom of restricting. A lot of times you only feel that way around that food because you're making it forbidden in your life. So learning to eat it in moderation, a lot of times will have you eating it less, you know, allowing the foods ends with you eating less of the foods, if that makes any sense. Mm-hmm. And I think that can be a really empowering thing to see.
Yes, I agree with you. And I don't want to give the impression that I don't have noodles. It's just, it's that thing of, I know that if I do have them, my response to simple carbs is that I get hungrier again quicker than if I exclude them. And I don't look at that as restriction. I look at that as, oh, I just don't really, I'll have that every once in a blue moon. And I think it's that switch as opposed to giving into the craving. But I want to talk to you as well about the different perspectives through which we look at our bodies and the way that we eat. Because again, I have a really good friend who has really fought for her life, in fairness, from a restrictive eating disorder, has fought really, really hard. And I feel as though I've had my own tumultuous journey from an overeating disorder. And we are very good friends and we love each other, but we are fundamentally at odds, and we really, we have to just agree to disagree on quite a few things, because my coping mechanisms to her are major red flags, which is to change the composition of my food. I lost 30 pounds when I first read Brain Over Binge. I was like, I'm not going to restrict anything. And I love an apricot croissant, so I'm going to have an apricot croissant every week. And I dropped the weight while still having my beloved apricot croissant. But now I don't have it, not because I'm restricting, but because actually I don't like how I feel when I eat something like that. So I will have it, but I won't have it as frequently as I used to. So for her, me saying that is like a, but that sounds like restriction, Emma. Equally, when she talks to me about her coping mechanism and about how she'll have anything and she doesn't, she will snack and all of these things that for me would be dangerous and would tip me back into old patterns of behavior, they really work for her. So we're constantly at odds whilst loving each other deeply. and it's that perspective thing, isn't it? And I think we talk so much about restrictive eating disorders and we understand the complexities of those, but I don't think people are as literate in the complexities of overeating disorders. And bearing all of that in mind, more people are impacted by an overeating disorder than by by restrictive eating disorders.
Yeah, it's a good point. And I alluded to that a little in the beginning, that I tend to see people on both spectrums, that some people are really from that dieting background, even like anorexia. And that was my background as well. And for those people, I think that allowing the food, really learning to tell yourself that you can have anything and learn how to not restrict and learn how to have that croissant every day is great. It's really, really, really helpful. But for people who really have overeaten since childhood, who have this habit of just constantly eating and having whatever they want, then it is more a little bit more about reining it in and learning to see how foods affect you and choosing foods based on not only how they taste, but how they make you feel. Now, that also can apply to the restricting type people as well, but I think they need to get through a period of really allowing and making sure they're not going back down that path. But no one wants to be eating just, you know, junk forever. No one wants to just be like following just their taste all the time, because we have so many modern foods that are really overly stimulating. And I think everyone at some point needs to step back and say, okay, like, how is this making me feel? And that's not, I think you make a good point that you don't see it as restrictive, and it's not, it's a self-caring practice, but it's a little more, I was going to use the word dangerous. I don't know if that's the right word, but for someone with a restricting background to start doing that, like, because they could get triggered down an unhealthy path. Like, oh, well, this makes me feel bad and this makes me feel bad. And then suddenly they're back to restricting. So it is a very individual journey of how, you know, different foods are allowed or just not restricted, but just denied because in favor of other foods that make you feel better. I like to think of it as like you're choosing a food instead of the croissant, you're choosing something that makes you feel better, that you still enjoy, but that doesn't leave you feeling bad. And that's not restriction. That's just making a choice. It's not like you're eating nothing, you know? So I think that's the difference, if that made sense.
Mm-hmm. I guess I would be, it'd be wrong of me not to bring this up, seeing as it's so topical. But what do you make of Ozempic?
That's a good question. I'm actually having a podcast come out. I interviewed an eating disorder expert about it. And I do think it's a problem for the eating disorder world, especially with the restricting types, the people who are always looking for unhealthy ways to, or ways to lose weight, no matter how unhealthy they are. I mean, it's a big topic, and I think it's contraindicated for people with eating disorders. And I think it's probably being prescribed to people with eating disorders, like, because they're not telling their doctor, which is, I think, a very scary and dangerous thing. So I think anyone with an eating disorder would be best to stay away from these medications. That's my, you know, non-medical advice.
So we'll go into a little bit what it does, but I think just to talk about people with eating disorders, I've been doing some research recently. And when I read the figures about the number of people who are known to be impacted by an overeating disorder, something that doesn't necessarily fit the exact definition of binge eating disorder, but is in that neighborhood, it's vast. And what really struck me is that I said it in the introduction, for a long time, I thought I was greedy and lazy, had no willpower. But actually, to understand that what I was dealing with was, and it is described as a mental illness when you interrogate any mental health professional about eating disorders, it made me wonder about the amount of people who are eating and don't realize that the way in which they are eating is actually part of a disordered eating. So that's one thing. And then you talk about Ozempic and being prescribed for people with eating disorders and that potentially being a danger. But I've listened to a lot of podcasts recently about Ozempic, which, well, and now it's an appetite inhibitor, isn't it? That was prescribed or designed for diabetics who were really struggling with insulin resistance and therefore weight management. And when I have heard accounts from people, and even friends of mine who have taken it, or a similar brand, or a similar type, maybe a watered down version, they all say the same thing, which is like, I think this is how skinny people must feel. I think this is just how normal people must live their lives, because I don't think about food anymore.
You know, it's, and you can't have that without side effects. That's, I guess, what I would tell people is that, okay, like, I can see it possibly having a use for people who, you know, really can't control their appetites. They're just constantly eating. And like you said, it could potentially bring people back down to feeling normal. But what side effects is it having? Like, this is literally slowing down the emptying of the digestive system. It's affecting hormones, insulin, and there are side effects. Like, what is it? Thyroid cancer is like one of the big ones, gastroparesis. So is it worth it to you? Like, you know, people who, this is an example I thought of like people who are alcoholics, we don't just like shut off their desire, their thirst. Like, I feel like people who are overeating, we can't just shut off their desire for food artificially. I think it's a matter of learning to work with our body and learning how to do it in a natural way is just more sustainable. I mean, not to mention the cost, not to mention the fact that people who are on this, you know, need to stay on it. Otherwise they gain the weight back. I don't think it's a long-term side effect free solution. Although again, I'm not a doctor, any, you know, medical decisions are between you and your doctor, but I wrote in Brain Over Binge that I took a medication that did that for me. It was actually anti-seizure medication that at the time they were prescribing for people with binge eating. And it did a very similar thing. It shut down my appetite just overall. But it didn't work forever. It worked for about 3 months. I binged so much less over those 3 months. I lost weight. But I feel like if I would have stayed on it and it would have kept quote unquote working, I probably would have been in big danger of going back down the anorexia path, because it really cut down my appetite. And I worry about malnourishment in people who are on this. Like, it's really allowing people to kind of starve themselves without having that natural biological survival drive that often leads to binging. And of course, we don't want it to lead to binging, but that survival response is very important. Like, we are supposed to feel driven to eat. We're supposed to have these appetites. That's how we survive as humans. So we start shutting that down across the board. I just can't see it being a good thing long-term.
Yeah. And my thing that I come back to is I feel incredibly grateful that I have shut down or definitely quietened down the chatter of the food stories in my head. And it sounds like what I've done over a period of time, your book obviously really helped, is the sort of instantaneous effect of Ozempic. So I would rather say to somebody, well, look, here are the tools that it's going to be a slightly longer journey, but these are going to last. And they're going to be less expensive. So with that in mind, as we draw to the end of our time together, if someone is listening to this and they're thinking, right, I'm going to be really honest with myself here. I don't necessarily fuel myself and feed myself in a way that is doing me good, that is supporting my long-term health goals, or indeed how I want to look or feel. What is step number one?
I would think to look into binging and see if that's what you're struggling with. Like you mentioned, there could be people out there overeating and eating in ways that feel bad and not even realize that they're struggling with binge eating, you know? And, you know, I guess the definitions, you know, between overeating and binging can sometimes get clouded, but really take an honest look at your behavior. And if you're really feeling out of control around food, just get information on binging. I mean, I provide plenty at Brain Over Binge. You can look into my books. You can, you know, just start seeking out that support. Obviously, telling your doctor is an important thing too. I always try to encourage people to get whatever medical help they need, because eating disorders do have medical consequences. So, I mean, I do think that's an important step one. I mean, just looking at your behavior, seeing, kind of defining what you're struggling with and seeking that medical support if necessary, and looking for any, you know, outside help that you need.
What role does exercise take in this entire process for you? Because in the book, you talk about the excessive. I mean, I could really feel you when you're on the cross trainer for like hour number three and the guy is like, when are you getting off that thing? But you were so emotionally connected to that machine because you had those calories to burn off because you were purging with exercise. What role does exercise play in recovery, do you think? I mean, you can talk about your own and you can talk generally about how you've then worked with other people.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, for me, the desire to exercise for those long hours went away when I stopped binging, because I felt so out of control during the binges that when my control came back, I felt like I have to do something about this. I have to, quote unquote, correct it, when really it just perpetuated the whole cycle. But at the time, that was the only solution I could think of. I tried self-induced vomiting, which is super dangerous, would never recommend anyone doing that. Thankfully, I never could. So exercise was what I turned to. And once I stopped binging, there was no need to do that anymore. I still enjoy exercise. I exercise probably 6 days a week, you know, 30 minutes, something like that. I mean, weights, running, things like that, but it's not something that consumes my life. And I do think exercise is a very important thing, but when people are ready for it, really depends. I mean, people who are in underweight and real medical risk, exercise a lot of times is not advised. People who are more on the overeating side, overweight, I think exercise can be a really helpful thing for mental state. I mean, it helps increase, you know, all the feel good brain chemicals. It makes you feel better. It helps you start building those healthy behaviors. And I do think it's helpful as far as helping your body reach that natural weight that's for you. I mean, it's not the only thing, of course. We need to look at a lot of healthy habits, but exercise I do promote, unless people have a really negative association with it, unless it's really triggering for them. But yeah, healthy, moderate exercise, I think, is a very important thing.
I was chatting to friends at a dinner the other day and they were saying, which is very nice of them to say, but they were saying, you know, Emma, like, what's your secret? How have you done it? And I said, actually, honestly, I released, because I used to run a lot. I used to run every single day. I ran half marathons and everything. And I said, actually, I started exercising less, but I trusted that if I did 3 strength training sessions a week and I did that consistently over a period of 6 months, consistency with some, you know, days off along the way, because life gets in the way, I would trust that over 6 months, I would reap the benefits. So I really detached from the exercise having any impact on a sort of atoning for what I had eaten. I relaxed and detached from this idea that it would make me look a certain way, and just focused on the repetitive action and the consistency and how that made me feel. And that is that is one of the greatest feelings I have ever been able to tap into.
That's amazing. Yeah, it's really disconnecting all those negative associations with exercise. And so many people with eating disorders use exercise as a way to punish themselves, as a way to compensate for the calories, you know, burn a certain number of calories. It's just, that makes it very unenjoyable, when exercise can be a very enjoyable thing. It can really make you feel good and healthy. And that's what I try to teach people, to develop positive associations with exercise that really have nothing to do with food or weight.
If I've been sitting down and having this conversation with you 6 years ago, my eyes would have been a lot bigger. They probably would have been a bit wet with tears, and I would have been desperate for you to tell me a secret. And I would have told you that I had tried everything, and I would have told you that I wanted it more than I wanted anything else. And then I would have gone away and I would have eaten in a way that did not support that, what I just said. And I just always want to try and meet people where they are. And if anyone is listening to this and feels like that, because I think you've probably experienced this way more than someone like me, having spoken to and worked with so many people over the years who have experienced this kind of issue with food and eating disorders and binging, you can feel so, so helpless, and you can feel like there just is no way out. And I think it's really brilliant to read your book and realize that there is. And I hope that I can add to that voice and say there really is, for somebody who was desperate. So I'm just curious, from your experience, if someone is listening to this and they are thinking, I've tried everything, there's no way, it's just never going to happen to me, and hands up, that's really what I thought before I read Brain Over Binge. I thought I just have to accept that I'm plus size. If someone's there, what would you say to them?
I think what you just said is really powerful, that you were there. I was there. I was 100% where you are. Like, I can't overcome this. Recovery is for other people. I have this for the rest of my life. I'll be binging for the rest of my life. And if I can do it, honestly, there's nothing special about me. You read my book, I'm a mess. Like, you know, like, I put everything out there in the book. Like, binging controlled my life. I felt like every day was just a struggle. Every day was, how am I going to overcome this? How is it possible for me to live without this? And sitting here, you know, 18 years later, 18 years removed from my last binge, I promise you it's possible. And it may not come right away. It may not happen like a light switch. But if you keep practicing, if you keep learning, if you keep trying different things, you will find something that works for you, and you can live free of the binging habit.
I'm going to ask you one final question, actually, which is about having shared this, because I've had this situation, which means I'm guessing you've had it too. I'm obviously a lot closer to my most recent binge than you are. And sometimes, having shared all of this, somebody will DM me and might just say, oh my God, I binged last night, and will just sort of explain what happened. And I'm really glad that I've created a safe space where they feel like they can say it, because even the fact that you can say it to somebody is really freeing and is incredibly helpful. But I would be lying if I said that it didn't sometimes rattle my recovery. And I wondered if you've ever had that experience of, you share, but you have to share in a boundaried way because you don't want it to impact the journey that you're on.
Yeah, I mean, I feel like I am so far removed from my recovery that that's not a thing anymore, as far as like worrying it's going to impact me at all. In the beginning, I mean, by the time I published the book, I was like 6 years from my last binge. So I still felt pretty solid, but I can't say that I never thought about it. I mean, for sure, like, someone would say, oh, I binged after like 5 years. I'm like, oh, is that possible? You know? So there's definitely, you know, just being able to hold space for someone, to listen to them and still stay on your own journey. I think I've been able to do that pretty well. The thing that comes up for me now is like, when people say, oh, I just binged, I read your book, but I, you know, it didn't work and things like that. I wish so much that my book could help everyone, because I don't want anyone stuck in this binge eating habit. But what I do know is that even people who do read the book and who do binge, like that doesn't mean you won't get better. That means that you just need to get more practice. Like there's people who binge several times after reading the book and still go on to have a complete recovery. Like it is something that happens on different timelines, like I've said a few times in this show. But I wish it could help everyone. But my goal is really is to provide an alternative to what's already out there. And if this is just a piece of your own recovery, then I feel like I'll have done my job. Like if this just adds something to what you're already doing, if you want to take some, take what makes sense to you for my approach and leave the rest. But I think recovery and what I've learned over the years is it an individual thing and just looks a little different for each person. But I hope that, the ideas I provide can provide some positive benefit for you.
I think that's the thing I really came away with is I didn't feel that your book was prescriptive. I felt it offered your experience and then I could take from it what I needed. And in understanding that the call was coming from inside the house, I kind of knew with clarity what it was that I needed to take away. And like I said, it's like I went to bed that night and I woke up and it was like I'd had a software update and I looked at food completely differently. And that's obviously a really wonderful experience. And as I said, my recovery hasn't been linear, but I've never gone back to the way that I was before, ever.
Which is great because some people who do binge think, oh, I'm back to square one, I'll never get this. But no, like you just keep going. You realize that all a binge means is that you acted on one urge. It just means your primitive brain called you to binge because that's its job right now, because it's maintaining a habit. And you followed it one time and you can not follow it the next time. And the less you follow it, the weaker it gets until it just goes away. I mean, anyone who's ever broken a habit knows that the desire eventually goes away. You know, with food, there's some more nuance and complexity because we all have to keep eating. It's not like stopping smoking when you can just never touch a cigarette again, but you have to keep eating. So there's a journey there, but you absolutely have the power to do this. And that's the message I really wanted to get across in Brain Over Binge, that no one is broken. No one is beyond help, that we all, have the ability to change our brains and live without binging.
Well, I owe you a huge debt of gratitude because the book really was a very significant, there were a few domino pieces. I've talked about them before. I had my breast reduction. Then in my recovery, I had my picture taken with Elizabeth Hurley. Never have your picture taken with Elizabeth Hurley ever.
Good idea.
I honestly go online and try to find a bad picture of Elizabeth Hurley. None exist. She is just one of those people. And then based on how terrible I felt then, I finally read your book on someone's recommendation. But after, when they had originally suggested it to me, I had wanted to punch them in the face because I was like, I don't binge. I don't overeat, because I was that far in denial about my own actions. So it was a really significant domino in one of the most empowering journeys I've ever been on and continue to be on. So thank you so, so much. I will, of course, put the link to Brain Over Binge, both editions, into the show notes. I will put the link to your podcast. And if there are any specific podcast episodes that are a great entry point that you think listeners should find, let me know and I'll make sure that that one is flagged up in the show notes. And I'll obviously share your social media details so people can follow you. But Catherine, thank you so much for coming on the show.
Yeah, thank you so much, Emma. It was a pleasure.
Thank you so much for listening to that episode of The Emma Gunn Show. I do hope you enjoyed it. I appreciate your time hugely. If you did enjoy it and you never want to miss an episode, then please do hit the subscribe button wherever it is that you are streaming and downloading this episode. It's also where you get the opportunity to leave a 5-star review and a rating for how you feel about the show, and I'd be so grateful if you wouldn't mind leaving one. If you want to get in touch with me, email me at thebeautypodcast@gmail.com. I would love to hear from you. Or you can DM me on Instagram and Twitter, where I am at Emma Gunns. If you fancy chatting to me and thousands of other fellow listeners of the podcast, then click the link to join the Facebook forum. The link to join is in the show notes, which can be found wherever it is that you are streaming and downloading this episode. You have to answer a couple of questions, but we cannot wait to see you there. Come over and join the conversation. Thank you so much for listening. I will see you on the next one.
Mom Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.